Chamber of Commerce will come to order at 3:22 on April 11th, and we do have a quorum. We have Representative Chenault, Representative Thompson, Representative Sadler, Representative Miller, and myself, Chair Olson, and we have one person in transit, I believe. We have two items on the calendar today, House Bill 72 and Senate Bill 23. We have an abbreviated meeting. We have another meeting at 4:30, so we're going to start with Ed Sniffen on House Bill 72. And I thought you were bringing charts and...
Well, we hopefully Conrad has distributed a couple of handouts that I'm going to walk you through. We tried to get a PowerPoint set up to...
Can we get you to identify yourself?
Yes.
I mean, most of us know you, but the people outside the room probably don't.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed Sniffen, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. One of my functions include enforcement of Alaska's antitrust statutes, which this bill obviously relates to.
And welcome back.
Yes. Well, thank you. And I think last week there was some presentation about HB 72 and what it was intended to do. I think Gretchen Stach from Representative Groenberg's office tried to walk the committee through some of the issues that the bill addresses. And there were a number of questions from the committee about that, and so I'm here to hopefully answer those questions and maybe walk the committee through some of the concepts that this bill is trying to address.
Why don't you start with concepts?
Yes, and to do that, we do have a couple of handouts, I think, in your packet, and one of them looks like this. It's like a flow chart that starts with the top. It says a conspiracy between a couple of suppliers, and at the bottom it says the consumer, who is the indirect purchaser. And what this chart shows is what our current statute tries to address. What happens in antitrust land is sometimes a couple of suppliers will conspire with each other to fix the price of a component that finds its way into a product. And an example that I can give you is one that we're currently working on with the state of California, and that's memory chips that you find in computers. These DRAM chips, or dynamic random access memory chips. There was some price-fixing conduct between a couple of the manufacturers who manufacture those chips. Those chips actually imported to the U.S. to an importer. They go to a distributor. They actually end up at a wholesaler. They find their ways into computers. The computers find their way to Best Buy. Consumers go to Best Buy, and they buy the computers. And the computers are marginally a little more expensive because a piece of that computer has a component that was price-fixed. Under a 1977 U.S. Supreme Court case, the consumer is without a remedy in this case because the consumer didn't buy the computer chip. The consumer bought the computer, and the computer had the chip in it. And so the consumer is considered an indirect purchaser of the price-fixed product. And the U.S. Supreme Court says, well, you're not really in the direct chain of command with the bad players, and so you don't have the right to sue those people for damages. But what the U.S. Supreme Court did say was states were free, though, to adopt their own laws that would provide for a remedy for consumers so they could actually sue these people directly for indirect damages. And so in 2006, we passed that law, and we call those laws Illinois brick repealers because the Supreme Court case that set the law of the land that said you can't do this is a case called Illinois Brick. And so we have a statute that effectively repeals that, and it allows consumers to actually bring actions against the suppliers who actually engaged in the illegal conduct. So that's the 30,000-foot view of what these indirect purchasers are all about. There are people who buy products that might have something in them, but they weren't really a direct purchaser of the price-fixed product themselves. So in 2006, when we passed Alaska's law, we had an option. We could either make our law an AG-only law, or we could make it a law that would allow AGs and private parties to bring these actions. And at the time, a number of states said, well, if you're going to do this, let's just let the Attorney General bring these actions against these bad people, because if we have class actions out there and private people and the Attorney General trying to do all this together, there's going to be a mess. And in 2006, I actually testified before the legislature that it was our preference for an AG-only law, and that's what we ended up passing. Since then, we've had some time to work with this law, and there have been a number of issues that have arisen with the fact that our statute only allows the Attorney General to bring these actions on behalf of consumers. And so what Representative Gruenberg's bill does, it changes that to allow private parties and class action plaintiffs to actually bring cases against the conspirators in this case for these indirect damages. And in this computer chip case, I mentioned the DRAM case, we call it, there's an issue going on right now where a number of the states, and the second handout in your packet actually is a map that shows number of states that have AG-only indirect purchaser laws, and then states with AG and private indirect purchaser laws. And as you can see, the majority of states allow both the Attorney General and private parties to bring these kinds of actions. But in the DRAM case right now, we're trying to settle some claims, and that case involves a number of states who have got together to bring this action, and the states that have an AG-only law are having a difficult time settling the case because the class action plaintiffs in that case can't settle the case for consumers. Only the Attorney General can in those states that have an AG-only law, like Alaska. So we're trying to deal with those issues now in the settlement context, but it has created a couple of little problems in that regard. So it would changing the law to allow private individuals to also bring these causes of action would alleviate some of these problems that we've identified over the last few years working with this law. And I think the legislation contains a provision that would actually require anyone who is contemplating bringing a class action lawsuit for these indirect damages to actually notify the Attorney General, and we would have a number of days to decide if we were going to pursue the action. If we decided we were not going to, then the private parties could pursue it. So it would satisfy some concerns we had that if we had multiple cases going on at the same time, there might be a conflict in how the cases were prosecuted and what kind of evidence would be available and shared and some other things. So that's the 30,000-foot view of what this bill would do. It would change the statute to allow private parties to bring these kinds of actions as opposed to just the Attorney General, and that's the effect it would have. So I hope that's helpful. I hope I didn't speak too fast. And if there are any questions, of course, I'm happy to answer any of them.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you.
Yes.
I think I followed it, but the quick question is if a private party I'm sorry, through the chair, Mr. Sniffen, if a private party notifies the Attorney General and the AG's got a certain number of days, weeks to make a decision, does the AG relieve that private party of the ability to pursue that case? He basically assumes it and takes it over from there, or does he work in conjunction with, or is it purely notification for information?
Yes, Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's an excellent question, and it would be something, yes, it would be something that we would consider doing a number of ways. We could determine to bring the action to the exclusion of the private party. We may decide to stay out and let the private party go it alone, and there would be an opportunity for us to actually pursue it jointly. For example, we might allow the class action to go forward, and then we might join the case for the sole purpose of just recovering penalties, but not actually recovering damages for the consumers. We would let the class action party represent consumers, and we would represent the state's interest in recovering penalties. So there would be an opportunity to do a number of those different things.
The penalties being fines?
Yeah, that's correct. Under our statute, the current statute anyway, we could assess penalties of up to $25,000 for every violation. There's actually some legislation pending that we're hoping will give us a stronger penalty provision for these kinds of antitrust claims, but currently we would have to pursue those claims under our Consumer Protection Act.
And I might add that bill is moving in the Senate as we speak, and then that's what the late Representative Holmes is now with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, exactly.
Mr. Chairman, just out of curiosity, have we accepted the work draft before us, or are we still speaking off of the original House Bill 72?
No, I know it wasn't me, so it must have been.
Yeah, I'm pretty objectionable.
It very easily been.
Are you going to remove your objection?
I remove my objection.
I can't even see my objective at this point, but I worked with my objective.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't care.
But I was so confused.
I came out of I was just curious as to which draft we were looking at. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
M. Ed, last time we had this bill, we had a question on what effect it would have on foreign corporations.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I was aware of that question, and I thought about that a little bit. And if the question is, could we enforce something like this against a foreign corporation doing business in Alaska, the answer is probably yes. Most foreign corporations actually have subsidiaries that operate in Alaska. For example, BP Alaska is a subsidiary of BP Petroleum, you know, out of London, and they do business here under that name. A lot of the bigger companies that do business in Alaska have subsidiaries here that operate under an Alaska name. But if they're doing business here at all, they're most likely registered to do business with a division of corporations, you know, as a foreign company doing business in Alaska. And if they're doing business here, we can get them one way or another.
Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, just to make sure for the record there's no confusion, I have removed my objection to considering the work draft 27LSO381/M, just to be clear. Thanks.
How about the repealers in Section 14?
What that would do, those sections that would be repealed are the sections that limit this kind of recovery to only the Attorney General. And so those sections would be removed, and the modifications to the other sections would take care of that in the sense that they would allow both a private individual or the Attorney General to bring these actions.
Yeah. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many cases are we talking about? You've talked about one case. Are we talking about 1,000?
Three? Representative Johnson, through the chair, no, we're not talking about 1,000, but we're talking about more than one. In the 10 years I've been doing this job, we've probably had maybe a dozen multi-state cases that we have worked on that have, you know, implicated this statute in one way or another, where we either have been unable to pursue claims because we didn't have the statute early on. Now that we do have it, we're able to join you know, other states in cases to recover these damages. The computer chip case I mentioned was one. 2 years ago, we had a case against a pharmaceutical company, Warner Chilcott, for a drug called Avcon. And if we had had you know, this in place, then we might have been able to recover, you know, some additional damages. There have been a number of different patent challenges to generic drugs that have implicated indirect purchaser damages that, you know, we have had pursued. There have been a few other cases that we have not pursued, and I'm not sure if this change had been in effect and there had been an opportunity for class action, you know, counsel to pursue those claims. Whether they would have or not, hard to say, speculate, you know, only on that. So, but there are a number of them that seem to come up. Not so many that are just Alaska only. It's more broader conduct that affects the nation, and consumers in Alaska just happen to be roped in there. And hard to say whether or not some of those would be pursued by private individuals as opposed to the Attorney General's office if we had this legislation.
Paul?
Thank you. And if it's a federal case, federal court, there's nothing precluding Alaskan from joining that class action suit now, is there?
Representative Johnson, the chair, that's correct. Federal antitrust law gives all the states the jurisdiction to actually enforce federal law in federal court. Federal law, though, has this restriction on the collection of indirect purchaser damages under the Illinois BRIC rule, and they have not repealed that, so we wouldn't be able to pursue indirect damages in those cases anyway.
Follow-up.
So the only indirect damages we'll be able to pursue are those cases filed in state court?
Either in state court or in federal court, if we had state court claims, we call pendant claims, that would follow along with the federal court action. So if we would, for example, join a federal suit, we would also have to bring Alaska claims in federal court for these kinds of indirect damages, which we have done since 2006, since this law has passed.
So even though the federal law says that the individuals can't, if we bring it along as a state suit, And an individual suit would be in the same category, even though the feds say you can't? It's not, they're not precluded from doing it because the state has it, even though it's contradictory to federal law?
That's, through the chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct. And I know it sounds a little confusing, and let me give you an example. In this computer chip case that I had mentioned earlier, that case is a federal case. It was brought in California Federal District Court. Alaska and 30 other states joined in, and when we joined in that case, we filed an amended complaint that included a section that had Alaska claims in it. And in that particular case, the conduct occurred prior to the time we had our Illinois brick repealer statute, so the judge kicked us out, basically, of the case because we couldn't pursue those damages on behalf of the consumers. And we actually ended up settling that some of those claims before we got kicked out of the case, so we are still in the case to recover those settlement amounts. But all the other states who had Illinois brick repealer statutes were able to assert those claims in that federal district court case, and the federal court is applying state law in federal court in that case.
You got that?
There's a reason I didn't go along.
I thought chemistry was bad.
I think that probably made sense to one person on the committee.
Trust us.
New question.
Yeah. So I think what I'm hearing is we need this. Is that your opinion?
Through the chair.
In the 10 cases or so we've had?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, it would help in those cases where we have decided not to pursue claims, and it would help in cases where we are trying to do global settlements in cases where there have been private class action suits also joined in the case, because currently in those kinds of cases, we can't settle those cases on behalf of consumers because only the Attorney General can represent those individuals. So unless we actually bring a case to represent individual defendants, and a lot of times we don't, we represent our state agencies who buy computers, that's who we're looking out for. A lot of times we leave it to the class action bar to take care of individual consumers. So it would help in some of those cases. I don't know that it's something that, you know, would come up that often in a lot of cases that we do. But I'd be curious to see if it was changed, if there would be more class action activity on behalf of Alaska consumers, because they would be allowed to do this. Currently, they can't do it.
What you just said is the state may be taking over some of these cases. We're not putting poor attorneys out of work, are we?
Through the chair, not that I know of.
Because I wouldn't want to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sadler, followed by Representative Chenault.
Thank you, the Chair, Mr. Sniffen. I'm looking at page 4 of the work draft here. My question is, I appreciate this chart here. How many, roughly, what proportion of the states that do allow the Attorney General and plus private parties, plus classes, have the elements of this enforcement to recover aggregate damages by calculating using statistical sampling methods? Is that a feature of these other bills? And likewise, is the remedy in Section 12 of this bill that allows the court to order revocation of a business charter or license, are those common elements of these laws that are in red on this chart?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, yes and no. The Section 12 enforcement provision authorizing the sort of forfeiture or suspension of a business license is, I think, something unique to this bill. I haven't seen that in other state statutes. The Section 10 aggregate damages proof element is a common element in most repealer statute. It just makes calculating damages a lot easier with the flexibility to do some aggregate, sampling. And instead of having a consumer, for example, tell me how much you paid for your computer, we can take this many sales over this many number of people and calculate, well, the average harm to each individual consumer is X, and that's what that provision allows us to do.
Yes. Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed, you were talking about the possibility of cases. Could you give us a ballpark what you think? I know you said 10 in the last, I don't know how many years, but can you give us an idea of what that may have cost the state of Alaska to intercede into those different cases that we've been involved with?
Representative Chenault, through the chair, I don't know what the cost to the state has been, but it certainly takes resources from the Department of Law to, you know, follow these cases. And we do it on behalf of agencies where we think there's been significant harm to the state. And so we like to think we're covering our our expenses by recovering damages that we wouldn't otherwise recover. If we had private parties doing the same thing, I don't know if it would have cost us less money. We might have decided to pursue some of these anyway, but there may have been some of those cases where we would have let the private bar, you know, deal with them if we thought that would have been an effective way to stop the conduct and get a recovery for consumers and state agencies if necessary.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are we going to be adding to the caseloads of the court system by enacting this?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I don't know. It's hard to say. These aren't numerous, you know, amount of cases out there that I can think of where these kinds of indirect damages are implicated. So allowing private parties to do them probably add a few cases, but I don't think it would be something where we're going to see hundreds of people rush into the courthouse to bring these cases. I think it's going to be a fairly limited number.
Along the same lines, if we increase the fines, are we more or less likely to see people willing to settle? I mean, are they willing to take it to court if it's a huge fine? Are they more likely to try it or take it all the way out as opposed to, you know, settling up front if they, you know, oh, I get out of this for X? What's going to be the response in your history of, I mean, if they got a $10 million fine on the line, they're more likely to fight it than they would for $1 million. There's a balance in there. So where are we in this balance of the fines in this, according to your
Representative Johnson, through the chair, this particular bill doesn't deal with the penalty provision quite so much, but I think you're right. There is a balance there where exposure to penalties and fines could be a strong motivator for people to either settle or litigate. It would, you know, depends on the company and, you know, the size of the company, the issues at stake, whether it's something that's important to them to set a precedent maybe for other cases and other things. But it's been our experience that the states that have stronger enforcement tools seem to end up settling cases quicker and more favorably than the states with weaker enforcement tools.
Thank you. Ed, Section 4. Page 4, I'm sorry, Section 12, page 4, using the sampling. Is that similar to what the feds are doing already with Medicare reimbursement, where they go out and audit the doctors, and they may find that 3% of the billings out of 100 are off, and they may have had 1,000 billings, and they automatically assume that the rest of them are in line with the sampling?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's a similar kind of analysis that this provision would allow in this bill. It would allow that a very similar kind of aggregation or, you know, statistical sampling.
We don't have
sampling
that at this point in time.
We do have it at this point in time, but we don't have it for private parties. So we're able to do that actually already when we bring our cases.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you think we're going to see more, I guess, more individual lawsuits brought on by, you know, I watch a little bit of TV occasionally, and it seems like every other night or there's some new different, we're either going to sue some doctor because of something that might have caused inefficiencies in kid growth or some hip joint replacement or something about some kids that might have ate grass that was fertilized with XYZ fertilizer. I mean, you know, where do these things stop or where do they begin? Are we, is, you know, I don't think that from what I see on cable TV is that the biggest supporter of cable TV is all these different lawyers that have class action lawsuits for just almost anything that I can think of that's wrong with me today. And so, you know, I just wonder, are we going to see more of those at an individual state level? And if we are, I think Representative Johnson was kind of alluding to it as far as what's going to happen in our court system and how much that's going to add to the court costs. And you know, then I start looking at it. And Mr. Chairman, I know we haven't got the fiscal notes. I was trying to stay away from it. But I see this is a zero fiscal note. And, you know, the more and more that we keep heaping upon our court system and our judicial system, the more those costs seem to increase. But we never say they're going to cost us anything until they come back in a year or two and say we need more money. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if that's really a question there that was fair to you, Ed, other than, you know, are we going to see more individual suits being filed because of this piece of legislation?
Representative Chenault, through the chair, it's not going to increase the number of suits that the Department of Law is going to bring. We're already doing what we need to do, and the statute currently allows us to do that. What you might see with this kind of legislation is one of the late night, you know, lawyer advertisers. They're going to bring their suits regardless of this legislation. And what it might do, though, is it'll allow them to represent Alaskans as part of that suit, whereas currently they probably can't. And so the suits are going to be filed anyway. It's just whether or not, you know, you can rope in Alaska consumers or not rope them in.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, if I may, if we pass this piece of legislation, do you think it will bring more suits filed in Alaska courts versus elsewhere in other states?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, hard to say. If it does, it won't be that many. I think it's likely that these suits are going to be filed elsewhere, and they're just going to be able to certify a class that now includes Alaska consumers, whereas currently they don't do that because these folks know only the Attorney General can actually recover those claims. So they would probably end up allowing, and they would send notices to folks in Alaska that they probably don't send now that says, we've certified this class. If you don't want to be part of it, you can opt out. That might generate a little interest for some of the local class action folks to maybe pursue this locally, but I hard to say, but I suspect it won't.
Mr. Chairman, just as a comment, anytime you get involved in the court system, it costs money.
Yes.
If they tell you that they're going to be cheap, it just means that they're probably not very good. That's been my experience. So, Mr. Chairman, take that for what it's worth.
Any further questions for Ed? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What about in-state? And I'm going to probably throw literally gasoline on the fire here. But what about the notion that there's price fixing on gasoline in Alaska? Is this going to allow individual citizens now to join in lawsuits to... And, you know, for I'll call it witch hunts because obviously you can tell where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
That just to go on a witch hunt on discovery and everything on antitrust. For, I mean, we have three oil producers. Is that an antitrust violation? Can 20 people get together and start using this as a violation and go to court? Can they, Tesoro, Mapco, any of the gas stations, the single refineries, are we in any way touching our Alaskan antitrust or trust violations, however you want to look at it?
Yes, Representative Johnson, through the chair, I know exactly where you're coming from on that, and yeah, that's a risk. Consumers who buy gasoline, for example, if one of our refiners was responsible for some kind of price-fixing conduct and they were, you know, conspiring with either other refiners or suppliers to do that, that gets passed on through the distributors, you know, through the jobbers, down to the retail stations and then to consumers. So the consumer is sort of the indirect sort of purchaser of the price-fixed product in a way. If the consumers wanted to sue the producers directly, they might have some problems because they don't really deal with the refiners directly, but because the gas doesn't really change and there's nothing really added to it, I mean, well, additives and cost of transportation, other things, that would be an interesting question. But this would clearly allow consumers to, in most cases, you know, if there was an argument that these were indirect damages, it would remove that barrier, and they would be allowed to pursue those claims.
Paula?
In the case of the North Pole refinery, would the consumers be able to sue the state because we're selling them royalty?
through the chair, Representative Johnson, I don't know the answer to that. That's kind of a complicated one. I don't think so. I mean, the state enjoys immunity for a lot of things. If there was something you know, the state did that was illegal in that sale of Royal Villa, which I can't think of anything illegal that goes going on there, they probably wouldn't be successful if they did sue. But just the mere fact that we're supplying that oil doesn't, you know, generate a cause of action. They have to find some other problem with that. And I suspect, given the state's posture in that transaction, we'd probably have immunity for that.
Follow up? New question? Comment?
Policy call.
Same question. If, as a policy, we decided to lower the cost of fuel to Fairbanks and we sold that at a below royalty cost, would we then be in a different situation based upon any number of constitutional issues and what's good for the people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Are we laying ourselves open by doing this? I mean, not, you know, I appreciate the chip makers, sure. I get all that, but I deal more with District 28 than I do Singapore or anyone else.
Sure.
So are we opening up a can of worms?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, in that particular scenario, I don't think this bill would really have any impact on the issues that arise on, you know, selling royalty oil for less than fair value for the, as you mentioned, the number of constitutional and other Supreme Court decision, you know, precedential reasons you know, for whether that's good or bad or legal or not legal. This would not affect that at all. It would just simply allow for a private individual to bring claims, if there were claims, you know, instead of just the Attorney General.
Okay. New question?
Sure.
I'm not sure. So it's grounds for a lawsuit. And so let's say it's the Tesoro station who is buying from an independent. Are we opening ourselves up, win, lose, or draw, to a bunch of lawsuits for people who think there's price fixing because we have one refinery? Can a citizen now go out and say, hey, I'm filing a lawsuit with this bill, as opposed to, I mean, where are we in that? What does that do? What does this do to that kind of scenario?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I'm not sure. This definitely does provide a cause of action that currently doesn't exist, you know, for any consumers who suffer these indirect damages. So if there was, under this scenario, a claim that somebody was indirectly harmed because of some upstream activity, that claim, and it was an antitrust claim, an antitrust violation, which the state is immune from for most, you know, things, currently the Attorney General would be the only person who could bring that claim. This would allow private individuals an opportunity to bring that claim if there were indirect damages as a result of some upstream conduct that currently doesn't exist.
One more question.
Go ahead.
Worth the risk? The 10 cases we've talked about over the 10 years you've been there, or however many cases, put the coin, worth the risk?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that's a policy call. I really don't know.
I knew that's what you were going to say.
Okay. Also, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to interject on a different bill, but on point on what we're discussing right now. About a year and a half ago, I contacted Mr. Sniffen because we had a price gouging bill. And Ed spent, as near as I can tell, well over a year looking at Tesoro, Flint Hills, and I don't know about Petrostar, but I know that you looked at least two of them, had more information made available to him than anybody that I know, and could not find, at least as of whenever he completed his investigation, that we had that problem at this point in time. I believe the Judiciary Committee at that point in time also looked at it, but then again, we didn't have this type of bill in front of us, and that's why I brought that up.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, that's exactly my point. We had some very capable, intelligent, I have a lot of confidence in Mr. Sniffen and most of the members, but to then put it into a court of law whenever 10 people get together causes me great concern. I would trust Mr. Sniffen investigating that and his judgment, but I'm not sure you get five or six people together in a class action lawsuit situation
you can find a judge somewhere that could cause some problems, and I have concerns, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, maybe this will put you at ease. It was my intention today to get Mr. Sniffen here so we could get more information on this bill. It wasn't my intention to move it today.
That causes me some comfort, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brief question, not being an attorney. Did you say that the state of Alaska is immune from antitrust violation?
Yes, Representative Sadler, through the chair. It's another sort of complicated answer, so I'll try to give it some of it. But generally, the state legislatures can authorize the state to engage in all kinds of price fixing and monopolistic practices, and if they authorize it, it's okay.
We're like the NFL.
So that applies to us as well?
Potentially, but the general rule is if the state is acting as a market participant and it's buying and selling out in the market and acting like a competitor, then it's subject to competition laws, antitrust laws, just like any other competitor. But where the state has actively engaged in reviewing and authorizing certain kinds of conduct, then that comes under a doctrine that allows the state to enjoy immunity for those kinds of things.
I could feel another painful question coming by the way you're holding your head.
No, I'm just wondering about the tax credits and stuff we gave to an exclusive person in the Cook Inlet. Does that subject us to antitrust?
Through the chair, Representative John, not that I'm aware of.
Not that I'm aware of.
Yes. Well, follow up, Representative Johnson, through the chair. Yeah, I haven't studied that issue in any detail, but I don't believe that would raise any antitrust claims at all.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, because you did mention that if we're in an open market, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is exactly what we're doing by offering credits to one company and not another one, are we involved in just throwing it out there as a concern? And I see my good friend, Representative Holmes, shaking her head no. We'll see when the other company comes in, and we'll see what they have to say about it.
Yes. Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think that we've exclusively offered credits to any one company.
First one down gets more than the second one.
Well, that's a race. Sorry, that's a race. No particular one when the piece of legislation was passed. Ed, when you were looking back at your things that the chairman had talked about you looking at before, when we talk about royalty into Flint Hills, isn't there a premium on that oil? Isn't there a royalty premium?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, as far as the cost that the oil is sold to the Flint Hills refinery for?
Yes.
I believe there is.
Okay. So it's sold at a premium, not a discount?
Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to argue with the speaker because that's not wise.
But my point was, if as a policy call we decide to lower it below that, would we then be involved in different aspect?
Mr. Chairman, I understood the direction he was coming from, but I just wanted to make the public aware that it's sold at a premium now and not at a discount.
Well, there's another advantage, too. They can flush their waste down taps.
That's correct. And they can put their resids back in the pipeline.
The quality bank is the mechanism. They pick up partial recovery on what that does.
Yeah, we are in the resources room, but this is way too familiar. Yeah.
Any further questions for Ed? Representative Sadler.
Just a general question about antitrust violations. In general, in the legal world, how much of antitrust damages are incurred directly and how much are incurred indirectly? Whether in Alaska or nationwide, just a general proportion.
Ooh, boy. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't have any exact splits on that as a percentage or anything. I know the feds, of course, pursue mostly direct damages, and they shake up all kinds of industries, the airline industry, the computer industry, transportation industries. And those are all direct damages. The indirect damages primarily come from the states because that's where the indirect damages are allowed. And indirect damages, I think, are fairly significant. But as a proportion to the direct damages, I would just be speculating.
And if I get larger as more states adopt this kind of make headroom for it.
That's correct, yes.
Well, thanks again, Ed.
Well, thank you very much.
We've got the sponsor and Gretchen in the room. If there are any questions for Representative Gruenberg or Gretchen.
There are a couple of things that maybe I could say.
Oh, certainly.
Thank you.
Thought about that too.
Just let me know.
Oh, okay. Thank you. This is the first time I had seen blue on the chart, and I was trying to find out what that meant. It looks from this.
Oh, can you say your name and affiliation for the record,
yes,
please?
Yes, I'm Max Gruenberg, the representative from House District 20. And this is Gretchen Stapp, who's my chief of staff and the attorney on the staff. When we met last week or a couple of weeks ago, we didn't give out a color chart. And I hadn't seen the blue before, so I wasn't sure where that fell. But if you count up, you'll see 22 red states, 8 brick states, 5 blue states, and 15 gray states. So that indicates where the states lie on this. The other chart here that Mr. Sniffen referred to was a chart that was, as I understand it, used when we passed the original bill giving the Attorney General the right to sue for indirect damages. Yeah. And that's why it says the legislation will give the AG authority. Under this bill, House Bill 72, it would simply extend that to private individuals. It does not create, in my opinion, any new cause of action. It simply allows a broader group of people to be able to bring the same cause of action. And I think, again, this is particularly important because Mr. Sniffen's office is fairly small. It's one of the smallest, I think, in the country. And the result is that in many cases where these issues arise, they're involving national corporations. And what this amounts to, then, is that people in Nebraska can join the lawsuit. People in Arizona can join the lawsuit, or any place where these private individuals, the red states, Arizona, no, but California, those. What they'll do is just add those people to the same lawsuit and will allow them to proceed under the laws of their state. Somebody asked, how does this work? And I'm going to explain. I think we covered it possibly, but I'll explain it again. These are generally in federal court under what's called diversity jurisdiction. Diversity jurisdiction applies if there's a certain threshold, and I forget what the amount is, it's fairly low, but there are citizens of different states. And the purpose is to resolve the disputes between the citizens of different states. And what they'll do is they'll have a group of citizens who are from Nevada, and they'll be able to proceed under the Nevada law. And then there are some people from Nebraska, and they could join the same lawsuit. All this will allow is the Alaskans to be able to join in under Alaskan law. And right now, in many cases, they're precluded from doing that. And since the computer chips are sold in Best Buy all over the country, it seems to me, in drafting this statute, is not very difficult. Just, it's unfair if somebody across the border can sue and get made whole, but our Alaskans can't. There's no reasons why we as a legislature shouldn't be protecting our own people in these national cases. And again, Mr. Sniffen, correct me if I'm incorrect in anything I say. I hope, Mr. Chair, you give him that latitude. He can bop me on the head.
That's a white hat.
They like it already. The question, as I understand it from Representative Johnson, had to do with if the legislature says somebody, one person, can charge a lower price or a higher price or whatever. As I understand the antitrust laws, and I didn't take antitrust, and we have the person with the highest grade in the class in Chicago, University of Chicago, sitting over there, and Mr. Sniffin, yeah, not you, but her. If it's permitted under state law or federal law, it's not an illegal restraint of trade because it's specifically permitted under the law. And if the law permits it, then that's an absolute defense. A motion to dismiss under Rule 12 would lie, and they'd be out, and the plaintiffs would have to pay their attorney's fees. And it's not designed to create an impediment. It's simply designed to protect against illegal collusion. And I would say if an oil company's colluded, or a supermarket, or a computer chip, or an asphalt manufacturer, this protects in any case. And it was not designed to be a subterfuge for anything, but simply to allow parity. And I think the trend definitely is to go in this direction. A question was asked, what if the company that's doing the colluding, the two companies, were, let's say, from another state, hypothetical to from a different country, can you sue them? The answer is yes, as long as the action occurred in Alaska. In Title IX, we have a statute that's called the jurisdictional statute. And if the illegal activity occurs in Alaska or affects Alaska consumers, then there is jurisdiction in the state. Or to apply state law if the case is brought in a federal court in Nebraska. Either way, they're covered. The constitutional question, whether we can do that constitutionally, as long as they have what's called minimum contacts. And if this affects Alaska consumers, then that statute in Title IX, I think it's Title 9.10.010, something right at the beginning, we can do it constitutionally as long as there's minimum contacts. And the way our statute, which is a long statute, has been interpreted is the statute allows Alaska law and the courts of Alaska to reach to the maximum extent constitutionally permissible. In fact, in California Civil Code, the statute simply says we have jurisdiction to the maximum extent constitutionally permissible, and that's the way our statute has been interpreted. Now, if the statute is applied and either the law of Alaska is applied in the case in Nebraska, the federal case or whatever, it could be in state court, or here, how do you effectuate and collect on the judgment? I don't think, Representative Sadler, I think that was your question, but I think you were getting, how do you effectuate the judgment? You would get probably a money judgment. People don't usually sue for an injunction or the divestiture of your license. By the way, the divestiture of the business license and stuff, that was taken specifically from Idaho law. We're not inventing the wheel anywhere here that I know of. But we have two statutes in Alaska. One, and these are in ASO 9.30. One is called the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act. And that is if you get a judgment, an Alaska judgment, you can simply register it in another state and they get a writ of execution in that state. It's designed to what's called domesticate the judgment in the other state. It's very simple, and I think virtually all, it's a uniform act, I think virtually all the states have adopted it. I could be wrong. If it's in a foreign country, we have a second, by the way, the first statute, the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, ASO 930-200-270. We have a second statute, Uniform Foreign Money Judgments Recognition Act, and that is designed with the other countries that are signatories to this to allow the same thing for money judgments involving a foreign defendant in a foreign country, or alternatively to
bagels.
Bagels. Bagels. Thank you, Steve.
or alternatively to enforce a foreign money judgment from another country. So we've covered basically the other states and most of the...
With smoked salmon dip.
And most of the other countries. I hope that answers your questions on those.
Maybe it's actual smoked salmon.
Lattes, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Representative Grunberg, we're going to hold this bill over. We've got about 15 minutes to get a CS out to the rest of the people that are waiting in the room. And,
all right.
But by any means, we're not done with it. We're just...
Okay.
Yeah. As you're well aware, we've had about 5 or 6 bills that have sucked all the oxygen out of the building for the last couple of weeks. And
thank you. Thank you for hearing it.
Thanks again. Thanks, Ed. Conrad. Pardon me? Now, let's get the CS out, and then we'll...
Yeah.
We've got 5 people online we can get through some of them. Thanks again, Gretchen.
Thank you.
Brief at ease. Brief at ease, welcome. Back on the record, the second item on the calendar today is SB 23, and basically, due to time constraints that we didn't know that we had until a few hours ago, what I wanted to do is get the CS out before the committee and out before the interested parties today. And then tomorrow we will be addressing some of the specifics. And, oh, we have at least 2 more amendments that are coming that may get attached to this here or get attached to it in the next committee. But at least I want to get this out. We may move it out in a day without, or we may attempt to move it out in a day without the some of the changes, but conceptually everybody will know what we're doing. But Conrad Jackson from my office will walk us through the changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson.
And I'd entertain a motion to adopt this for discussion purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill number 23, Labor and Commerce, 27 LS0252/G Bullock, 41011.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Anyway, walk us through it, Conrad, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The members have a copy before them that I went through and I have highlighted. You should have all of the new sections highlighted, but for the public, for the members in the audience behind me, the first change takes place on page 2, lines 26 through 30. It changes the audit provisions from the Senate CS version S, I believe that was, to 3 audits being 2013, 2017, and 2021, beginning of the legislative session, so basically January of those 3 years. This change was put in from some of the testimony we heard from legislative audit. It seemed to make sense to audit the initial program that's in place now, have an audit a couple of years before the full program sunsets, so there's an opportunity for the legislature to review that and determine if they want to continue the program, and then we just picked a year in the middle at 2017. The next change you'll see on page 3, line 9, we add the words in this title. By doing this, it allows the credits to be used by other taxpayers. That would be folks paying fish tax, insurance tax, you name it. Currently, the bill is limited to other payers of the Alaska net income tax. The next change is on, mark these as I go. The next change is on page 3, line 20 and 21. This changes the language of the aggregate amount of the program as it was, as the bill came to the committee. It would have been limited to $100 million through 2018, and then the second $100 million would kick in for the last 5 years of the proposed program. With this, the full $200 million in credits is available from day one through the last day. So there's no possibility of a gap. When they run out of $200 million in credits or 2023 comes along, the program goes away, as currently written. The next change you'll see is on page 4, line 14 through 16. This would add to the report that the film office makes to the legislature, a section that includes the expenditures paid by producers that were not qualified expenditures. Currently, we would be getting a report of the qualified expenditures. We ask that they tell us how much didn't qualify. The next change is on page 5, lines 11 and 12. This was brought up in the hearing on Friday, and actually, I guess, shortly after the hearing, and concern was expressed to me. We've changed that language on line 11 and 12 to read state policy on the utilization and development of natural resources of the state. The concern was the state of Alaska potentially giving credits to someone that says a film that was denouncing the aerial wolf hunting policy of the state of Alaska or the timber harvest in the Tongass. So we're tightening that up just a little bit. The next change occurs on page 6, line 25 and 26, that ensures that producers or production companies must be licensed to do business in the state of Alaska. Again, another issue brought up by a member of the committee. The next change is on page 7, line 26 through 30. This adds a new section to the bill. This was at the request of the department. Currently in Title 9, and I don't have my note in front of me, I believe it's Title 9, there is a 6-year statute of limitations for the state to go back and recover any wrongfully paid credits, wrongfully issued credits. So we've increased that from 1 year to 6 years. The next change is on page 8, line 1. Again, something that was mentioned in the last meeting. The concern was rural area could conceivably be rural Arkansas or Australia. You pick it. The drafter didn't feel that it was quite that loose, but at our request, he added the words "in the state." So there's no confusion. We intend for credits to go to films that are actually in the state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the changes. The following sections of the bill on page 8 and extended to a little bit on page 9 do not change. And as you said, there are some other amendments now that have come to light since this was this CS was received that we'll be working on as well.
Any questions for Conrad? Thanks, Conrad.
Okay. I'll do a brief one. In section 4, Conrad, you said that
basically any tax, I'm sorry, Representative Sather, through the chair, any tax under Title 43. At this point, the credits can only be used against an income tax liability. This would open it up. Some of the examples that I saw were insurance tax, fish tax. It's similar to the education tax. There are a number of them in there. I don't have a complete list.
And the concept being that the credits aren't going to be good unless there's somebody to interested in acquiring.
Mm-hmm. Could someone use up all the fish tax, all the insurance tax, and then move on to the next? If someone trying to cash in their tax credits, use them all up under one section of 4320, and then move on to the next section?
Representative Sather, through the chair, I don't believe that would be an issue. That might be better addressed by
the department. At the next meeting, when we have people that are testifying on that. Yeah. Right now we've got 6 people online that I'd like to get to real quick, and then we've got one person in the room whose indulgence I'm going to beg to carry her over till the next meeting, because she lives here in Juneau, and we've got a couple of our people in town, governmental people that we can get online. But first I'd like to go to Kenai, and I haven't even seen the list.
Randy Daly.
Randy Daly.
How you doing, Representative Olson?
Pretty good. Please say your name and affiliation, although I know who you are, but nobody else does.
Thomas R. Daly. I own and operate High Speed Gear. I'm also a member of the Alaska Film Group.
Please continue.
We often speak of the Alaskan economy as a three-legged stool, including government, energy, and all others. As an Alaskan business owner, my company saw a significant loss of revenue 3 years ago when the state of Alaska chose to stop allowing Alaskan-owned companies in the business equipment industry to bid on state contracts, effectively removing the government leg of our economic stool. This might have ended very badly for us if we had not been able to replace a portion of that income through involvement in the Alaska film industry. The production of Everybody Loves Whales, a major motion picture completely shot in Alaska, which benefited from the Film Incentive Program, provided this opportunity. ELW had an estimated direct and indirect economic impact of $16.5 million, filming in Anchorage, Barrow, and Seward. Over the last 2 years, filming and production-related activities have benefited 35 Alaska communities. The economic whale surfaced in a number of ways, 1,000 rolls in front of the camera, 100 Alaskan crew positions behind the camera, including 28 drivers, 7,900 man-hours of security services, catering, equipment rentals, and 12,100 nights of hotel rooms. To expand on the hotel room example, let's say a businessman wanted to match the economic impact of renting 12,100 hotel nights. That individual would spend 7 nights a week for the next 33 years and then some to match ELW. And I heard legislators get tired of hotel rooms after 90 days. So we can see direct benefits to multiple sectors of the economy. My business has made the decision to invest in the industry through further training and development of talent and technical positions, such as retraining our technical operatives to be digital versions of a loader, a technical term for the industry, providing the data-dense hard drive requirements of modern filming with qualified professionals. Other businesses wish to invest as well for bigger items, such as 10-ton grip trucks, $250,000, generator trailers, $100,000, lights at $20,000 to $45,000 each, all of which are specialized and expensive. An entry-level soundstage has a $10 to $20 million price tag. To make these investments, Alaskan business need to know that the state is a competitive place for filming. When we look at the competition for filming, we find that our current incentive packages is competitive but ending. However, other locations, such as British Columbia, that sees 200 productions a year, do not have a sunset clause in their incentive programs. We need companies to make long-term investments in order to drive Alaska higher and provide the stability required to make the investments necessary to capitalize on these new dollars coming into our economy. So for keeping the state competitive in the film production industry, for the growth of a more diversified economy, to endorse private investment, for all these reasons, and the ones times did not allow discussion for in this format, I am firmly in favor of renewing the firm industry incentive program and urge legislative support for a minimum of an additional 10-year term. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Randy. We take a question from Representative Chenault.
Hey, Randy. Mike Chenault.
How you doing, Mike?
Hey, I'm good. Question. Do you have the I can hear your passion in your voice in the film industry as far as credits and bringing jobs to Alaska. Do you have the same passion about the oil industry?
I haven't. The oil industry put me through high school and what college I got because of what it did for my parents.
Yep.
Me directly as a supplier to the oil industry have not had as pleasant of an experience as I've had with the film industry.
Thanks, Randy.
You bet.
Thanks, Randy. Wes Shaft. Chris Creek?
Hello. Hello.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Wes Shock. I'm affiliated with OmniTour AK, and I've been working with the film industry off and on for about 30 years now, and I fully support the bill there, extending the tax credits to the film industry.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Michael Neese, Homer.
Yes, hi, thank you. I would like to...
please state your name for and affiliation for the record, please.
Yes, sorry. My name is Michael Neese, and I have a company called Alaska Film Works. It's a workforce training company, and we train people vocationally and through academic means. Also, what I'd like to in reference to Mr. Daly's comments, one of the things I've been working in the film industry many years, almost 30 years, and to sunset our tax incentive program, I agree with him. I think we need to do work in the same vein as British Columbia, Halifax, Nova Scotia, to develop our industry and support our industry here. So just having said that, I agree with Mr. Daly on that, and I think that's good advice. So to make it short, because I know everybody's it's getting down there, I support the Senate Bill 23 and like to see that passed. I'd really appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Michael. I think we've got time for one more. And I believe, Greg Kern, we cut you off, or you cut us off, last meeting about halfway through. I wonder if you could again state your name and affiliation for the record and take up where you left off.
I'm sorry about the technical difficulties last time, fellas. My name is Greg Kern. I'm with AK Grip and Lighting in Anchorage, Alaska. It's a small mom-and-pop grip and lighting shop that provides the lights and generators and grip trucks akin to what the other fellows were talking about. I'm in support of this legislation to allow me a chance to get to go to the banks and get the long-term financing I need to grow my business in such a manner that I can actually employ more people and really make a go of this. As it stands right now, projects like Wales, which was a great project, I worked on it personally. We saw a lot of equipment come in, and when the project was done, we saw all that equipment leave. This is tantamount to carpet bagging, guys. And for a company like mine that's struggling to make it here in Alaska, I need a chance to sink my teeth into this stuff and get these the financing so I can compete with these guys. These guys are large corporations outside that are well-funded, and they're very used to going around into the certain different communities, such as Michigan and Louisiana, setting up shop and setting up a pipeline of money back to their home base in California or New York. What we're trying to do, or what I'm trying to do, and a lot of other small vendors are trying to do, is preempt that and try to get ourselves rooted here in Alaska so we really do have a chance to build an industry from the ground up. That's pretty much all I've got to add to the discussion today. I do appreciate your time, fellas. Thank you.
Oh, thanks again. And with that, we're going to be holding the bill over to tomorrow afternoon, and we are going to adjourn at 4:35.